Hello and welcome to Radio Book Club on Big Cabbage Radio 89.7. I'm Judy Getty and I will be hosting the show today as we discuss Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner? A story about women in economics by Katrine Marsal. My guest is Holly Bell, professor of economics. Welcome, Holly.
Hi, Judy. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we're going to get into some of the specific points that Marsal makes, but let's just start with an overview of the book itself. And I also want to say that economics for me is a stretch as far as understanding, and you know, we'll talk about that because some of the things she talks about, and she's not an economist either.
Right.
So some of the terms she uses are certainly, you know, ones that you can explain maybe a little better, and I'm, you know, going to ask you to do some of that. But her main theme is that women's work has been ignored in terms of looking at how it contributes to the economy. So just, you know, that's kind of how the book is presented and advertised. Do you agree with that premise?
Well, I think, first of all, let me just preface this discussion with my bias, having read the book.
Okay.
Okay, because I think it's important to kind of talk about that. And I think as far as the author goes, I think that her understanding of economics and economic application is thin. I think she is probably good with feminist theory. I think that, but her application to economics, I think, is a little thin. So I don't know that I necessarily agree with her premise. And so let's just talk about what economics is.
Okay.
First of all.
Sure.
So what economics is, and she doesn't really ever define this. And if we think about it at the most basic level, it's essentially how do societies distribute scarce resources? Because all resources are scarce, right? There's only so much oil. There's only so many iPhones. There's only so many of these things. So then how do we distribute those within a society? And the goal of economics is not necessarily to include every activity that every person does to contribute to the economy, but it's about measuring certain economic activities and then measuring them over and over and over again so you can compare them. So when she talks about women not being counted, essentially, in economics, that's not true. I mean, economics is essentially blind to gender. It doesn't care. But, you know, she's looking traditionally when women did not really participate in the economy. They were mostly caregivers at home, taking care of children, running households and things like that. And times have certainly changed. So more and more women are being counted in the economic activity that we measure every day.
Now so let me just go back to that thing that you said about certain things. So it's not everything.
Right. And it's not designed to be a measure of everything. Now, does a woman who has chosen to be a homemaker and is taking care of children and preparing meals and doing all of these things that support other people who are in the economy, does that contribute to the economy? Absolutely. But those are not the types of activities that we're measuring year over year. And so we're measuring certain activities year over year in order to be consistent.
And along with that, then, I mean, what was decided to measure and, you know, the way I kind of think about it is that those are the things we value. Do you think there's more value in saying, okay, we're going to measure these things, which are oftentimes men's work versus women's
caregiving?
Yeah, well,
I don't know if it's things that we value more, but they are certainly what I would call visible outputs, if that makes sense. So it's difficult to measure some of these more invisible outputs. And while women certainly contribute in other ways, in caregiving and other things, it's difficult to measure in terms of economics, because economics is not really measuring that. It's measuring actual physical outputs from an economy. So I would think of women in this scenario from an economic perspective as being an input. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So they are more on the input side and they're not on the output side, if that makes sense. At least historically. Today it's changed a lot.
Okay, but even using that statement, I mean, if we think about in her argument and you know, in feminist theory, talks about women as caretakers, mm-hmm. that why isn't that an output? Why isn't it that, you know, children who are raised in a healthy way or, you know, productive way, that's an output?
How do you measure that?
Precisely.
And so, that's the point. So it's taking the things that are easy to measure and measuring them consistently over and over again. So when you measure GDP, you're measuring outputs of an economy, for example, and you're going to measure that same basket of goods year over year over year over time in order to be able to compare how the economy is doing. If you're adding, you're trying to add additional things in over time, it's not really going to balance out very well because you'll be measuring apples and oranges. And so I think it's difficult to measure. I mean, that's the bottom line. How do you measure that?
But I think she does point out that in Canada, and I know I've seen another study where it says, if we had to put value on the work a caretaker in the home does, you know, so just, mm-hmm. you know, childcare, we know what it costs to have a full-time childcare. Mm-hmm. We know what it costs to have a housekeeper. We know what it costs to have, you know, a driver or taxi driver, whatever you want to call it. And mm-hmm. so when they put, you know, some kind of monetary value on those, and then they would add those up and say, this is what a homemaker's contribution is.
Well, I think there are other ways that we kind of look and measure other things. So for example, if we're measuring outputs in an economy, and one of the other measures we look at are things like workforce participation, right? And mm-hmm. so if workforce participation is rising, we know that there are more women in the workforce. So we're able to see very dramatically kind of what's going on there. If the workforce participation rate is falling, we have to look at that and say, why is that? And mm-hmm. it may be because more women are choosing to stay at home, or maybe more men are choosing to stay at home. We don't really know what that is. Mm-hmm. So there are other ways to kind of look at what the role is of women in the economy. So, for example, if the workforce participation rate is lower and more women are staying home, we know that that is their role in the economy, that they are serving that support role. But it's difficult at the end to measure it in a GDP number because it's not part of the basket of goods that we measure. And it doesn't mean that that's more valuable. It just means that it's easier to measure consistently over time.
Okay. So Marcel uses the term economic man. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's over and over again in the book. It's pretty consistent. And she has some rants against this term. But is that a term that you use in your field?
It's a term that's used in the field. It's really designed to be a gender neutral term. Think of it as an economic mankind.
Okay.
It's not a gender specific term. But I think what it really talks about is that trying to remove emotion from the decision making process and making decisions based on utility. Now, utility does not equal profit. And I think this is one area in which her understanding was a little bit thin. When we talk about utility, we're talking about essentially the want satisfying power of a good or service or of doing something, right? And so that does, in fact, include relationships. It does, in fact, include caregiving and other things that she doesn't seem to understand. So, for example, let's talk about utility for a minute. So if I decide that today for lunch I'm going to have pizza instead of a hamburger, I've made that decision because I get more utility from pizza than hamburger, meaning I'm more satisfied if I eat pizza than if I eat a hamburger. And so that's an economic decision that I just made. But on the other hand, if a woman, let's say, is making a decision to stay home and care for children versus go to work, and she has that option, it's because she gets more utility from that caring role than she does from going out in the workplace. Or I always talk about this example. If my husband decides that on a cold night we're walking along and I'm freezing and he decides that he's going to give me his coat and he's going to be cold, it's because he gets more utility from seeing me warm and comfortable and happy than he does from his own comfort.
So is that the same or different from cost-benefit analysis?
Well, it's similar.
Okay.
I mean, you know, because when we talk about cost-benefit analysis, we think of that in terms of monetary costs and benefits. But there's also opportunity costs, which is another concept that she doesn't really define particularly well in the book. And an opportunity cost is the cost of doing the next best thing we could be doing. So I'm here today talking to all of you, and everything I do has a cost. So my costs today are the things I could be doing other than being here talking with you, right? So I could be home sleeping. I could be at work. getting some work done, and that's my opportunity.
Eating that pizza?
Right, but I've decided I get more utility from being here talking with you today than I do from doing some of those other things. And so it's always these trade-offs. And so what happens oftentimes with women, I think, is that they have a higher opportunity cost. So, for example, they may have more utility from staying home and caring for children. That's more important to them than working. And so the opportunity cost of going to work is very high because you have to give up that role in order to go to work. Most surveys of women say that their ideal lifestyle is to work part-time and be able to and stay home with children. So and that's because of the opportunity costs. It's the opportunity cost of leaving children in daycare or something that they don't necessarily want to do. Now, do men have those same concerns? Some do, probably, and some don't. We just, you know, I think society is changing. Mm-hmm. I think this is a societal construct. I don't think this is a
biological construct.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a societal construct because I think men presume that they're going to go to work. Women don't presume that they're going to go to work. They assume they have to make a choice.
So, you know, all those things that you said, I agree with. But I'm thinking in terms of, and historically, so if you think, would you say Adam Smith is like the father of economics? And if so, do you think his thinking was that broad in looking at what economic human was about?
It wasn't necessarily as broad simply because the times were different. And so the frame within which he was actually dealing with economics was much different. Women couldn't inherit property. Women couldn't really be in the workplace. They could do work. They could do work like nursing, which nursing was an unpaid profession for many years. It was a volunteer job. It mm-hmm. wasn't something that women were ever paid for. And so, you know, things are definitely different now than they were in Adam Smith's time. So that wasn't really his frame of reference at that time.
And see, and I think that's what goes back to my thinking in terms of measuring what we value, going, you know, what you said. Because for Adam Smith, his lens, so to speak, was to look at men's work and what were men doing mm-hmm. and to not turn that lens on, you know, what his mother was doing, you know, like the title of the book, right. She was cooking his dinner and caring for him and his home and doing all of those things. And so that was, you know, historically an appropriate way of looking at the world. Mm-hmm.
But it's still really, you know, we still look at the same outputs in an economy. Mm-hmm. So in that way, how we measure economic activity has not changed just because of what economics is. It's how we distribute scarce resources. And those scarce resources are goods and services, and that are finished products that are out there in the marketplace, and that we don't measure those inputs.
So I have two things. I want to go back to that too. But Adam Smith talks about self-interest. Mm-hmm. So connect that term to what you were talking about in terms of utility or what we said cost
benefit. Right. So utility is really how an individual measures self-interest, right? So If I decide I'm hungry, I'm going to go to lunch, I need to get something to eat. Well, I'm really hungry for a pizza, so I'm going to try to find a pizza because that gives me more utility or more self-satisfaction than does a hamburger. And so that's really, utility is really the means by which that happens. And the question is there really any altruism, right?
Yeah.
And that's ultimately the question, because why would I, and this is something that I think economists think a lot about, is there really altruism? I mean, you know, if you throw yourself on a grenade to protect your platoon mates, that's a pretty altruistic thing to do because you aren't going to be there to receive the good feeling that happens after mm-hmm. saving their lives, mm-hmm. right? But for most decisions that we make every day, there's probably some self-interested motive, right? Why would I write a check to a charity? Because I feel strongly mm-hmm. about whatever that charity is doing, and I feel strongly about the issue. And so I get more utility from contributing to helping to solve that problem than I do from holding on to my money.
In the last few years, because, you know, I teach psychology, but mm-hmm. I've been just finding it fascinating how psychology and economics are so really related and overlap.
They absolutely are.
Yeah.
They really are.
And so when I talk about altruism in psychology classes, and we talk about that, and I ask the question, is there really such a thing as a selfless act?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, students will try to come up with examples, but then we talk about the emotional benefit, or, you know, the term you use is utility, that they gain
right.
from it. So.
And that's really what economics is about. It's about decision making.
So when you said that about it, it was almost like a measurement of tangible outputs, though, but some of these are intangible.
Some of them are very much intangible. And so it's not just about tangible. So we measure things like GDP in terms of tangible outputs. But then when we start talking at the individual level about how individuals make decisions. So we're talking about GDP or outputs. Those are macroeconomic factors. And when we're talking about how individuals make decisions, those are microeconomic factors.
Okay. I finally get a definition of those two things.
So that's kind
little
of the difference. So we look at that. Yeah.
Okay.
So you know, there is a difference. Now, in Adam Smith's day, there was no macroeconomics and microeconomics. Macroeconomics was simply the sum of everything that the individuals did. And so he just looked at economics as a whole. And it really wasn't until Keynes that macro and micro kind of diverged as fields of study.
Okay. So I've been so engrossed in what Holly's been saying that I haven't identified to our listeners that you are hearing us talk about the book Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner by Katrine Marsall. So one of the quotes I put down here is economics wasn't about money. From the beginning, it was about how we view people. Essentially, economics was a history of how we behave in order to profit from any given situation, in every situation, no matter what the consequences. So are you saying that there Marsall kind of gets it? Or?
Well, it's not about profit. It's about utility. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so profit, when I think of profit, I actually think of dollar amount.
Okay,
but it's really
but it
about
could be utility.
It could be, but I'm thinking it's really utility. So it's not only about how much money do I gain by engaging in a transaction, but also how much want satisfying power do I get from that action.
And just,
right?
I think out of fairness too, I think, you know, Marsall's book is translated. So we always
right.
wonder, you know, and in the translation,
mm-hmm.
you know, how words might be changed. So one of the other terms Adam Smith uses is the invisible hand. And again, economics is not my background, so I struggled
yeah.
with that. What's the invisible
hand?
Yeah,
and I think this is another thing the author doesn't do a particularly good job talking about. She makes it sound like the invisible hand is just kind of this overarching thing that just drives, you know, that Adam Smith claims drives the economy. But it's really more specific than that. The invisible hand is basically about how the economy uses the price mechanism to solve that problem of distribution of scarce goods, right? So, and it uses supply and demand
okay.
to determine the price, right? And so if I want a handful of grass, lawn grass, I can pretty much go out and get it. The
mm-hmm.
price is zero. Why? It's plentiful. It's everywhere. If I want a handful of lawn grass in January in Alaska, what happens to the price of getting that grass?
Okay.
You know, it goes way up, right? Because that is a very scarce resource for me in Alaska, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I either have to find someone who has a greenhouse who's maybe has some experimental sod that's growing there, or I have to go outside to get a handful of grass or something like that. So it's about using the price mechanism. That's what the invisible hand is all about. So as supply goes down, price goes up. As demand goes up, price goes up. As supply goes up, price goes down.
Mm-hmm.
More plentiful things are. And so that's what the invisible hand is. It says that really we use the price mechanism to determine who gets what of the scarce resources in an economy.
Okay. Well, that makes more sense.
And so it's not some magical force that totally drives the economy, but it is a self-regulating, self-correcting system.
And you know, and right after that, she's talking about the invisible sex again, because her
mm-hmm.
her premise is that women's work or contribution is not measured or included. So if we think in terms of that, I guess it's not. It wouldn't be related to the invisible hand, or did you see it?
No, okay. It's not related to the invisible hand. And to say that, you know, women are invisible in the economy, that's just not true. I mean, you know, 50% of the women in the workforce right now, or 50% of the people in the workforce are women.
Mm-hmm.
And so 50% of the economy is measured, you know, okay. That's coming from women. So, but what she's really saying is that outside of those measured items in an economy, women are not counted. But, you know, and that's really very much a social construct. Things have changed over time. Adam Smith certainly didn't talk about it because it just wasn't within his framework. And more and more men are choosing to stay at home and do these things now too. So I think it's not a gender issue. It's just how we measure the economy.
But the first efforts, according to Marsall, to look at women's contribution was the Chicago School.
Mm-hmm.
So do you, when you're teaching classes, do you talk about that and how initially it was included, but it was kind of done in a, I don't know, awkward or different approach?
Yeah,
I guess.
I mean, we really don't talk about this too much because we're really, in the classes that I teach, we're talking about kind of the basic theories, but that would be something more for an upper division class or graduate level class when you're looking more at, you know, economics of gender. I mean, there are classes in that that really, you know, do talk about that sort of thing. But okay. It's not something we really touch on in basic theory.
Okay. But a term that we hear a lot today is, and now you said his name and I've, you know, so it's Keynesian or how do you say?
Oh, Keynesian.
Keynesian?
Keynes and Keynesian, yeah.
Okay. So he talked about we create prosperity so that we could then live our lives. I mean, that was his mm-hmm. idea, right? Mm-hmm. That we would have this booming kind of economy and then everything would just kind of roll along and we could like sit back and enjoy that prosperity. So when we – because we still hear that term today.
Let's talk about the difference kind of between economics a la Smith versus Keynesian economics, because they're really two very different things. So if we look at Adam Smith, for example, he's really looking at economics as a whole. He's mostly concerned with individual decision making. And then all of that eventually becomes kind of an aggregate of that, which becomes kind of the macro economy. Mm-hmm. He doesn't really differentiate between the two. Keynes, however, he doesn't look at individual decision-making so much. He looks at the macroeconomic factors. And his whole theory is kind of opposite of Smith's in that he says, well, look, if we look at the macro level and we engage in government intervention and national self-sufficiency and all of these things, then we can get individuals to behave in the way that we want them to. And so that's kind of the difference. So Smith believes that individuals should have the freedom and that creates our economy. Keynes basically says, well, if we kind of try to create our economy, we can get individuals to then do what we want them to do in the economy. And that's kind of the difference there. So back to your original question, that we're going to create prosperity and then just go on with our lives. And I think, that's just impossible, that you're not going to have that steady economic growth over time. You're going to see fluctuations. It's inherently unstable. It's up and down all the time, depending on what people are doing. And so I think we do get to points where we certainly get to make choices between things like work and leisure, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so how often, you know, am I going to work 40 hours this week or I'm going to work 50 hours this week? And some of that is going to depend on how much money I need versus how much leisure I can have. So, you know, that's kind of measures of prosperity in economies, developed economies, is kind of what decisions are individuals making in that trade-off between work and leisure? Are they working less and playing more? Are they? And then we get into the situation where now leisure activities have gotten more expensive. And so people are working more just to have less leisure time that's more expensive. So, you know, it's.
And I was going to say, you know, in this country that seems to value work so much that, you know, even though they're doing well, even though people are prosperous, they continue to acquire.
Right. And some of that is because, you know, their leisure activities become sometimes more expensive. It's like, hey, now I can almost afford a boat. So if I just work this little bit more, I can buy the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I'm off, I can go out on my boat and
right.
I'll be happier. Right.
So with Keynes then, So he's related to the neoliberals. Is that neoliberal way of looking at the economy?
Well,
and
neoliberalism is essentially just another way of saying market-based capitalism.
And so because of that, though, before we got on the air, we were talking a little bit about the godlike sense of the economy. And so that's where I kind of was drawing that line or connecting the dots, that if this idea is that the market determines all.
Right. Well, here's the problem. So when we start talking about non-market-based economies, we have to ask the question, what does an economy with a socially optimal output or outcome look like? So, you know, if you're going to talk about, let's say you want some sort of, let's use an extreme. Let's say you want a communist economy, okay? So we'd have to say, well, what does that look like in its outcomes? What is the socially optimal outcome in a non-market-based economy? And the problem that we have when we start talking about non-market-based economies is that who is the all-knowing, benevolent third party who has all information, past, present, and future, who can determine what the socially optimal economic output looks like? And it's our ignorance about that that forces us to essentially rely on markets.
Okay, but can we use a different example? Because as soon as we say communism, then people,
everybody
it's like, okay, we know that's a bad idea.
Right.
But what if we just think in terms of like a hunter-gatherer society? Mm-hmm. So let's even think about in terms of our own Alaska Native. So like, you know, in the Yupik culture, where I would say that they didn't have a market society.
Well,
you know, the idea was that there was people whose job was to hunt, and then there was people whose job it was to process that, and then of course raising families, and so it's almost like the goal is survival.
Yeah, but and that's not really an economy in the sense that Smith or Keynes is measuring. I mean, that's subsistence. I mean, that's
so survival would not
itself.
Fit into.
Yeah,
that.
It's not really what fits within this framework of discussion of an economy is, and so.
So what's the element that has to be present in order for it to be considered an economy? That idea of profit, the idea of actual, of some kind of monetary element?
Well, I mean, it's an economy in the sense that there is trade, right? So I trade the berries I've gathered for meat, right? And it's just a different form and a different way of looking at it. But it doesn't measure things the way that we measure things in a Smithian-based economy. There's no prices, which is, you know, one of the issues. We can't really talk about the invisible hand or the price mechanism if there are no prices. And so that kind of doesn't put it within this framework.
Okay. So you're talking about lots of different elements that are involved. And one of the things that Marcel does touch on is I don't know if she actually called it an algorithm, but then this idea that because, of course, there's becoming more computer programs to kind of make these decisions for us on an individual level and maybe on even a macro level. So do you think that there's
not an economic algorithm per se, because people's utility and their wants and their feelings and their desires are always going to be there, and opportunity costs are always going to be there, and algorithms can't measure opportunity costs. They can't measure what I value, right? And so values are very much a part of this. Mm-hmm. And that's something that algorithms can't do. And I also, when you talk about algorithm, I'm reminded that Alan Greenspan once said, you know, we have the economy figured out, and we've figured out how to have a stable, steady economy. And then the 2007-2008 financial crisis happened. So, we don't, and there's no way you're ever going to control it completely. But the nice thing about a market-based system is that it reacts and is relatively self-correcting. And so that's the good thing about a market-based system. That's the only thing that's somewhat algorithmic about it. It will have an extreme reaction, and then it will recover.
Okay. I want to go back to a point about that. But first, I want to let our listeners know you're listening to Radio Book Club on Big Cabbage Radio. And we are talking about Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner, a story about women in economics by Katrine Marsal. And Holly Bell is here with me and expanding my brain.
Stretch it.
So last month and next month, I've been talking about a book on the air, Homo Deus. And one of the things that the author of that book talks about is how, in some ways, because computers are constantly data mining, you know, everything we touch and look at almost on our screens, that to some degree they can project and predict what we're going to buy.
Yeah, to some extent. Yeah, so, I mean, you think about the time you went to a website and looked at something, and then the next thing you know, it's the ad on your Facebook page, right?
I've been looking for some light shade replacements, and they're everywhere now on every page I open up.
Exactly.
I'm like, it's almost like I don't need a reminder to buy these things because it's on every page I look at.
Right.
So I just think there might be some future in that, but what goes along with that is thinking that the market is rational. And when we think in terms of, on the other hand, that human beings are not always rational.
Yeah. I always tell my students, if you've ever been in love, you know that you're not always rational, right?
Right.
But they have to, and again, all of these are theories. And so they're based on certain assumptions. You have to have certain assumptions going into the models. And one of the assumptions is that people will behave rationally to the best of their ability. Right. And what is a rational decision for me may not be a rational decision for you.
Mm-hmm.
And for very rational reasons.
Right.
But
then
we're going
to go back
to
that self-interest and utility.
Right. We're going to make very different decisions.
So you brought up 2007, 2008 as kind of an example of where things went a little sideways with the market. And I, you know, what's the film that was done about the mortgage crisis?
Oh, The Big Short.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
That was like, okay, so many people I talked to, it was like, that didn't make sense. A lot of the things I read about the 2008 crash didn't make sense. But I have to say, I liked her comparison to
analogy.
What David Bowie did.
Yes.
And then it was like, oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that having seen The Big Short, it's very accurate. The movie is actually quite an accurate portrayal of what happened during that crisis. But yeah, the book talks about what David Bowie did, the musician, and he has this library, of course, of music. And as he sells music, he gets royalties. As he makes more music, he gets royalties. And at some point, what he decided to do was basically take that catalog of music, sell it to investors. And so he got his money up front, and then his investors are allowed then to collect royalties in the future, which, you see artists are starting to do that. And what he's really participating in is the futures market, right? And so he's basically selling future profits to investors. And they have confidence that David Bowie is going to continue to make music that's going to sell and that his existing music will continue to sell. The thing about the futures market is, it's very risky.
Mm-hmm. And I knew that's why I wanted to bring up that whole idea of risk now.
And most investors understand that the futures market is very risky. What happened with these bank loans? So the bank loans, so there are several factors here. So what happened was I went out, took out a mortgage. My bank gave me a mortgage. And then what the bank did was they bundled all these mortgages and they sold them to investors in the form of securities. Right. Now, there are two problems with that. First of all, one of the reasons banks did this and banks tried to transfer their risk away from their bank and to others was because they were being forced to make loans that were much riskier than they would prefer to make. And that was because of some government policies about increasing their proportion of loans that were going to lower income houses and lower income households and some other factors. That was actually government mandates that they were kind of forced to do this. Did they go too far? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of how that started. But then when they basically said, well, that's okay because you can, basically get those loans off your books, then there's no incentive to stop making risky loans,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you can get your money up front. So that was one problem with that whole situation. The second problem was the basic assumption that home mortgages were low risk, even as futures, because home values will continue to rise year over year. And that is absolutely not true. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason, now historically, if you look at the very long run, that's true. Right. But in any short run period, that's not necessarily true. So the reason why it used to be where you'd go to get a mortgage and you had to have 20% down to get a mortgage loan, that used to be the way it was before FHA and some of these other programs came along. And the reason for that was because banks knew that in the short run, the price of a home would not generally drop by more than 20%.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so there were all sorts of statisticians who had made that decision. And that is why banks were requiring 20% down. And so then we had, you know, a terrible scenario happen in which housing prices, at least in a lot of major markets, plummeted. Now, the other mistake that banks made is not only did they bundle these loans and try to get them off the books, some of these banks then bought those bundled securities.
Uh-huh.
So they essentially reacquired risk. They were not rated properly for risk because they were mortgage-backed. And so that assumption about housing prices going up was really the reason why that happened.
Yeah, it was all on shaky ground there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, yeah, and while I found that interesting, this is where one of the problems I had with the book because, you know, I'm thinking, on the cover, it says a story of women in economics. And then she goes off on these other trails. And I'm thinking, how does this support that argument.
Mm-hmm.
So interesting, but, you know, again, not what I thought her main point was. So along with that, Ben.
Well, I will say this, though.
Okay.
I think maybe some thoughts that I saw her talk about in the book was that, you know, maybe women are less likely to take risks at these levels. And so I think maybe that's her tie-in to that.
Okay.
Somehow.
Well, she does open the book with that, referring to somebody's comment about if it had been Lehman sisters instead of Lehman brothers. But
right.
her thinking is that universe would have, so many different things would have had to have happened for that to even be in place that
right.
it's not even an argument. So I brought along another book that Holly and I have both read, but we admitted it's been a while, and that's Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. And Marcel does refer to that because a lot of Kahneman's research is on risk avoidance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting because one of his parts of his research is how we make decisions, and we don't always make decisions based on like facts.
Yeah, well, we have, you know, something called bounded rationality. So when we talk about being rational decision makers, we're really talking about bounded rationality. Because if I want to buy a car, for example, and I go to all my local car dealerships, I can't possibly go to every car dealership in the country to compare, you know, service and price and all of these things. And I can't really take my car reasonably to Arizona to get it repaired. And so I have to make decisions based on the information that I can get.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's that issue of bounded rationality. And so there's always risk. So we always know that we don't have all information. It's the same reason why, you know, in science, we never accept a null hypothesis. We always fail to reject it, right? Because we don't have all information to prove that, yes, this is true.
Okay.
And so we do try to avoid risk to some extent. So we have, one of the things Kahneman talks about is status quo bias.
Right.
Right. And how we're more likely to keep things the way they are and how we know them rather than take a risk and do something else. And that goes back to that issue of opportunity cost I talked about. Right. So
mm-hmm.
not only am I giving up what I'm doing right now, but I'm giving up the security of what I know and what I'm doing. So my opportunity costs become very high to go do this risky thing. So how many people talk about writing a book and never write that book because there's risk associated
mm-hmm.
with that, right? How many people talk about opening a restaurant, would really like to open a restaurant, but, you know, I'm making an okay living and I have everything that I need. And do I really want to, you know, my opportunity costs are high to drop all of that and go pursue this other thing. And so I think one of the things that Smith talks about, though, is that, you know, those who take risks often get rewarded, right? And so higher risk, higher reward.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the question that societies have is, should people who, you know, do take risks be allowed to profit handsomely from that and be rewarded for it?
So you say that's a question that society asks?
Well, sometimes okay. societies have that, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's that, did you build it question.
So do you think that goes along with, you know, the magnificent kinds of bonuses that CEOs are getting now? Anything can be taken to an extreme.
Right. Anything can be taken to an extreme. And sometimes, you know, CEOs, they're trading salary for stock options or some other thing. You know, sometimes they have a lot of their compensation is tied to performance. And so that's an incentive effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're trying to incent them to perform well in order to get their actual pay.
Right. Mm-hmm. But what would have been enough? I mean, you know, that
right.
becomes
yeah.
the
so
question.
Right, yeah. So what's enough? And, you know, that's a question that can't be answered. Because one of the other key constructs, especially of Smithian economics, but really all economics, is that we are never satisfied.
But we have a price. And I think that, you know, when we, you know, and some economists' research is about that, too, is asking, you know, how much would you take for this?
Right.
Yes.
Exactly. Right.
So it's kind of interesting. I mean, it can be anything from you own a mug. How much is it valued versus how much is that mug valued if it's just sitting there? So if we own something, it has more value.
Right.
We risk losing it.
It's the opportunity cost.
Yeah.
So you have the actual price plus the opportunity cost. And that's an economic accounting issue. You know, mm-hmm. any value of something has the explicit and the implicit. And the implicit is the opportunity cost associated with it. So I give up this mug. I now have to find one that I like as well or better.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that has a cost to me. I don't want to do that.
So that leads right into the next thing I wanted to talk about was economic incentives and how it affects human motivation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Smith is all about incentives. Right. It's all about I'm back on Kahneman in my mind here
mm-hmm.
for just a minute. But, you know, how do we incent people to behave in the way we want them to behave? And so some of the ways that you get people off of status quo bias, for example, is to make their status quo different. So we talked a little bit about retirement plans,
mm-hmm.
right? So most people, if you have to go out and actually sign up for your company's retirement plan, you won't do it because it takes time to do that.
And you have to think about it.
Yeah, but if the status quo is the company automatically takes 3% out of your paycheck and puts it into your savings account, you won't go back and change it.
Right.
And so,
what I was reading about that was they use the term inertia.
Right.
Where, you know, if we have to take some action, we're less likely to do it.
Again, it's an opportunity cost, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm not saving for retirement and I've been getting that extra 3% in my paycheck, do I want to give that up?
Right.
And so it becomes an opportunity cost issue. But yeah, economic incentives and Smith's economic incentives, his perspective on that, it was pretty harsh. I mean, you know, his is about, how do we incent people to work by letting them starve by not working? I mean, you know, that's kind of
a Dickens.
That's kind of it is kind of that way. How do we incent people to work? How do we incent people not to engage in bad behavior? Well, you know, by not supporting them when
mm-hmm.
they engage in the bad behavior.
Or locking them up. Yep.
Yep. And so, but economic incentives do affect human motivation, right? Because if you're hungry, you're going to figure out a way to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and those are extreme examples.
So let's bring it back a little bit to, you know, her talk about women in economics and this idea about care as work. So once we incentivize that by putting a figure on it, we still say that, you know, those are low wages that are assigned to that kind of thing. So when we look at care work, it often means low wages, and it often means that those are the jobs women are holding.
So what types of jobs do you consider care work?
Daycare centers,
mm-hmm.
Personal care attendants, individuals who might work in, say, a senior mm-hmm. living center.
Yeah. So, yeah. And those tend to be low paying jobs. But the question is, are they low paying because women are doing them, or Are they, you know, and so it's that incentive effect. Who's willing to do those jobs? Now, if no one is willing to do those jobs at those pay rates, the pay rates will have to go up.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as the marketplace is still supporting enough people in those, you know, willing to take those jobs for those low wage rates, there's no incentives for wage rates to go up. It's that price mechanism. So think of supply and demand in the labor market, right? So we have demand for caregivers and we have a supply of caregivers. And if the demand goes up but the supply doesn't go up, what's going to happen? We're going to have to raise prices, meaning wage rates for those positions. If there's still more people willing to supply that type of labor than there is demand, then wage rates will remain low. And so it's a basic, probably economic supply and demand issue that is keeping those wage rates low.
And also, I would think because a lot of those are may not be for profit.
Right. And they may not be for profit. And it also has a lot to do with the people who are going into that line of work and what is their utility that they receive. And if the wage rate, let's say, is the same between being a daycare worker versus, say, working at McDonald's, and I don't know that it is, but let's just say it is. If you gain more utility, if you have more utility value from caring for other people, you're certainly going to take the caring job versus working at McDonald's.
Okay.
So maybe it just means there's a lot of good people still out there.
Wow. Okay. So I do want to just briefly talk about human capital as a term, and, mm-hmm. and maybe that fits in with a lot of what you're talking about in terms of well, why people go into particular kinds of work. But it also, I think, in psychology, we talk about this too, is like, almost like an investment in yourself.
Right.
And how do you better yourself so that you're more marketable?
Right. And, yeah. And we know there are statistics that show that if you have a college degree, you make more money. If you have a master's degree, you make more money. And so, yes, you can certainly invest in yourself and your skill set, and that will make you more valuable in the workplace. So versus – so being an RN versus being a – home health care worker, for example, is going to result in better paid because you've invested in that education and your skill set.
So do you think Marcel ends on a hopeful or an optimistic note?
She doesn't seem particularly optimistic to me. And I think one of the things that I found really interesting, that and one of the things I think she did well, was this issue about, you know, why are women always measured in relationship to men, in relation to men, and never in their own terms? And I think that's ultimately, I think, her biggest concern is why, for example, if a woman, if a woman is described, so this happens to me, people describe me as guy-like, and I say, well, what does that mean? And they say, well, you're rational, and I'll say, why does that make me guy-like,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it's because rational is a term that gets associated with men.
Mm-hmm.
And emotional, for example, might get associated with women. And so I think in that point, she's very right. We do get described in terms of how we mimic the behaviors of men versus in our own right. And so I think that ultimately is the social change that needs to happen that will improve a lot of what she's concerned about.
And so she doesn't, I think some of the criticism of the book was that she doesn't delineate very well what those next steps should be.
Right. She doesn't really have action items.
Right. Yes. Yeah. But, you know, based on what you just said, I mean, in moving forward, you know, that has to be a level of consciousness then that it's brought to the field of economics and brought right. to how things are measured and,
yes.
and talked
and
about.
And I would encourage listeners who are listening to this and who find us rational to just say, wow, those are two really rational people.
Yes.
And not to say they're rational for women.
Thank you. Yes. Goes without saying. I want to thank Holly for joining me as we discuss Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner, a story about women in economics by Katrine Marsal. Next month will be part two of Peter and Matt joining me to continue our discussion of Homo Deus, A Brief History of Tomorrow by Yuval Noah Harari. I also want to remind listeners that 89.7 is a community radio station that relies on support from listeners like you, so please take the time to visit our website, radiofreepalmer.org, and become a contributing or a sustaining member. This is Judy Getty with Radio Book Club. Happy reading.